to my chamber to prick out my song, It Is Decreed, intending to have it ready to give Mr. Harris on Thursday when we meet for him to sing, believing that he will do it more right than a woman that sings better, unless it were Nip, which I cannot have opportunity to teach it to. This evening I came home from Whitehall with Sir William Penn, who fell in talk about his going to sea this year, and the difficulties that arises to him. Talked afterwards, and she had the confidence to say she came with a hope to be time enough to be my valentine, and so indeed she did. But my oath preserved me from losing any time with her. And so I and my boy abroad by coach to Westminster, where did two or three businesses, and then home to the Change, and did much business there. My Lord Sandwich is, it seems, with his fleet at Aldborough Bay. So home to dinner, and then to the office, where till 12 almost at night, and then home to supper and to bed. The 3rd of November. This morning comes Mr. Lovett and brings me my print of the Passion, varnished by him, and the frame black, which indeed is very fine, though not so fine the office, only met at the door with Mistress Martin and Burroughs, who I took in and drank with, but was afeard my wife should see them, they being, especially the first, a twattling gossip. And so, after drinking with
and told him that he was now at a great height. At last, though with very little hope, he began walking to his right, keeping contact with the roof by raising his arms. Presently it receded beyond his reach. A long time after that he heard a sound of water. He went on more slowly, in great fear of encountering a waterfall. The shingle began to be wet, and finally he stood in a little pool. Turning to his left he found, indeed, a waterfall, but it was a tiny stream with no force of water that could endanger him. He knelt in the rippling pool and drank from the fall, and put his aching head and weary shoulders under it. Then, greatly refreshed, he tried to work his way up it. Though the stones were slippery with some kind of moss and many of the pools were deep, it presented no serious difficulties. In about 20 minutes he had reached the top, and as far as he could judge by shouting and noticing the echoes, he was now in a very large cave indeed. He took the stream for guidance and proceeded to follow it up. In that featureless dark it was some sort of company. Some real hope, distinct from that mere convention of hope which supports men in desperate situations, began to enter his mind. It was shortly after this that he began to be worried by the noises. The last faint booming of the sea in the little hole whence he had started out so many hours ago had now died away, and the predominant sound was the gentle tinkling of the stream. But he now began to think that he heard other noises mixed with it. Sometimes it would be a dull plump, as if something had slipped into one of the pools behind him. Sometimes, more mysteriously, a dry rattling sound, as if metal were being dragged over the stones. At first he put it down to imagination. Then he stopped once or twice to listen, and heard nothing. But each time when he went on it began again. At last, stopping once more, he heard it quite unmistakably. Could it be that the unman had, after all, come to life and was still following him? But that seemed improbable, for its whole plan had been to escape. It was not so easy to dispose of the other possibility that these caverns might have inhabitants. All this experience, indeed, assured him that if there were such inhabitants, they would probably be harmless. But somehow he could not quite believe that anything which lived in such a place would be agreeable. And a little echo of the unman's, or was it Weston's, talk came back to him. All beautiful on the surface, but down inside, darkness, heat, horror, and stink. Then it occurred to him that if some creature were following him up the stream, it might be well for him to leave its banks and wait till the creature had gone past. But if it were hunting him, it would presumably hunt by scent, and in any case he would not risk losing the stream. In the end he went on. Whether through weakness, for he was now very hungry indeed, or because the noises behind made him involuntarily quicken his pace, he found himself unpleasantly hot, and even the stream did not appear very refreshing when he put his feet in it. He began to think that whether he were pursued or not, he must have a short rest. But just at that moment he saw the light. His eyes had been mocked so often before that he would not at first believe it. He shut them while he counted 100 and looked again. He turned round and sat down for several minutes, praying that it might not be a delusion, and looked again. Well, said Ransom, if it is a delusion, it's a pretty stubborn one. A very dim, tiny, quivering luminosity, slightly red in colour, was before him. It was too weak to illuminate anything else, and in that world of blackness he could not tell whether it was 5 feet or 5 miles away. He set out at once with beating heart. Thank heaven, the stream appeared to be leading him towards it. While he thought it was still a long way off, he found himself almost stepping into it. It was a circle of light lying on the surface of the water, which thereabouts formed a deepish, trembling pool. It came from above. Stepping into the pool, he looked up. An irregularly shaped patch of light, now quite distinctly red, was immediately above him. This time it was strong enough to show...
5th of August. Up and all the morning at the office, we're busy, and at noon home to dinner, and Creed dined with us, who tells me that Sir Henry Bellasis is dead of the duel he fought about 10 days ago with Tom Porter, and it is pretty to see how the world talk of them as a couple of fools that killed one another out of love. After dinner to the office a while, and then with my wife to the temple, where I light, and sent her to the tailor's, I to my bookseller's, where by and by I met Mr. Evelyn, and talked of several things, but particularly of the times, and he tells me that wise men do prepare to remove abroad what they have, for that we must be ruined, our case being past relief. The kingdom so much in debt, and the king minding nothing but his lust, going 2 days a week to see my Lady Castlemaine at Sir Daniel Harvey's. He gone? Some of them have the last night had a word among them, and it was reformation and reducement. This doth make the courtiers ill at ease to see this spirit among people, though they think this matter will not come to much. But it speaks people's mind. And then they do say that there are men of understanding among them that have been of Cromwell's army, but how true that is I know not. Thence walked a little to Westminster, but met with nobody to spend any time with, and so by coach homeward, and in Seething Lane met young Mistress Daniel, and I stopped, and she had been at my house but found nobody within, and tells me that she drew me for her Valentine this year. So I took her into the coach and was going to the other end of the town with her, thinking to have taken her abroad. But remembering that I was to go out with my wife this afternoon, I only did hacer her para tocar my prick con her hand, which did hacer me hacer, and so to a milliner at the corner shop. The 11th of July. At the office all the morning, after dinner to the King's Playhouse to see an old play of Shirley's, called Hyde Park, the first day acted, where horses are brought upon the stage, but is but a very moderate play, only an excellent epilogue spoke by Beck Marshall. So thence home and to my office, and then to supper and to bed, and overnight took some pills. The 12th of July, which work with me pretty betimes, going into Bishopsgate and Leadenhall Street, and there did give her 8 pair of gloves, and so dismissed her. And so I home and to dinner, and there with my wife to the King's Playhouse to see The Storm, which we did, but without much pleasure, it being but a mean play compared with The Tempest at the Duke of York's, though Nip did act her part of grief very well. Thence with my wife and Deb by coach to Islington to the old house, and there ate and drank till it was almost night, and then home, being in fear of meeting the prentices, who are many of them yet, they say, abroad in the fields. But we got well home, and so I to my chamber a while, and then to supper and to bed. The 26th of March. Up betimes to the office, where by and by my Lord Brunker and I met, and made an end of our business betimes, so I away with him to Mistress Williams's, and there dined. And thence I alone to the Duke of York's house to see the new play called The Man is the Master. I met with Mr. Moore, who tells me that my Lord Hinchingbroke is now with his mistress, but not that he is married, as Will Howe came and told us the other day. So by coach to Whitehall, and there stayed a little, thinking to see Sir George Carteret, but missed him. And so, by coach, took up my wife, and so home and as far as Bow, where we stayed and drank, and there, passing by Mr. Lowther and his lady, They stopped, and we talked a little with them, they being in their gilt coach, and so parted. And presently came to us Mr. Andrews, whom I had not seen a good while, who, as other merchants do, doth all give over any hopes of things doing well, and so he spends his time here most, playing at bowls. After drinking together at the coach side, we with great pleasure home, and so to the office where I dispatched my business, and home to supper and to bed. The 9th of August. Up and betimes with Sir Hugh Cholmondeley upon some accounts of Tangier, and then he and being Lord's Day, and so I within all day, busy all the morning upon some accounts with Will Hewer, and at noon, an excellent dinner, comes Pelling, and Will Howe, and the latter stayed and talked with me all the afternoon, and in the evening comes Mr. Mills and his wife, and supped and talked with me, and so to bed. This last night, Betty Mitchell, about midnight, cries out, and my wife goes to her, and she brings forth a girl, and this afternoon is christened, and my wife godmother again to a Betty. The 13th of July. Up and to my office, and thence by water to Whitehall to attend the council, but did not, and so home to dinner, and so out with my wife and Deb and Will Hewer towards Cooper's. But I light and walk to Duck Lane, and there to the booksellers at the Bible, whose mohair you have a mind to, but ella no era dentro. But I did there look upon and buy some books, and made way for coming again to the man, which pleases me. Thence to Reeves's, and there saw some, and... The 10th of March. Up where the house was, it being not above 1 o'clock, very full, but my wife and Deb being there before with Mistress Pierce and Corbett and Betty Turner, whom my wife carried with her, they made me room, and there I sat, it costing me 8 shillings upon them in oranges at 6 pence apiece. By and by the king came, and we sat just under him, so that I durst not turn my back all the play. The play is a translation out of French, and the plot Spanish, but not anything extraordinary at all in it, though translated by Sir William Davenant. And so I found the king and his company did think meanly of it, though there was here and there something pretty, but the most of the mirth was sorry poor stuff, of eating of sack posset and slabbering themselves, and mirth fit for clowns. The prologue but poor, and the epilogue little in it but the extraordinariness of it being sung by Harris, and another in the form of a ballet. Thence, by agreement, we all of us to the Blue Balls, hard by, whither Mr. Pierce also goes with us, and to the office, where all the morning doing business, and at noon to the change, and there very busy, and so home to dinner with my wife to a good hog's haslet, a piece of meat I love, but have not et of, I think, this 7 year. And after dinner abroad by coach, set her at Mistress Hunt's, and I to Whitehall, and at the Privy Seal office inquired, and found the bill come for the Corporation of the Royal Fishery, whereof the Duke of York is made present governor, and several other very great persons, to the number of 32, made his assistance for their lives, to Westminster, to Mr. Burgess, and then walked in the hall. And he and I talked, and he doth really declare that he expects that of necessity this kingdom will fall back again to a commonwealth, and other wise men are of the same mind, this family doing all that silly men can do to make themselves unable to support their kingdom, minding their lust and their pleasure, and making their government so chargeable that people do well remember better things were done, and better managed, and with much less charge, under a commonwealth than they have been by this king, and doth seem to resolve to wind up his businesses, and get money in his hand against the turn doth come. After some talk, I by coach and there dined, and with us Mr. Batalier, by chance coming in to speak with me. And when I came home, I find Mr. Goodgroom, my wife's singing master, there. I did soundly rattle him for neglecting her so much as he hath done, she having not learned 3 songs these 3 months and more. After dinner my wife spoke a little perspective, and was mightily pleased with seeing objects in a dark room. And so to Cooper's, and spent the afternoon with them, and it will be an excellent picture. Thence my people all by water to Deptford to see Balty, while I to buy my espinet, which I did now agree for, and did at Hallward's meet with Mr. Thacker and heard him play on the harpsichon, so as I never heard man before, I think. So home, it being almost night, and there find in the garden Pelling, who hath brought Tempest, Wallington, and Pelham to sing, and there had most excellent music, late in the dark, with great pleasure, made them drink and eat, and so with much pleasure to bed, but above all with little Wallington. This morning I was let blood, and did bleed about 14 ounces towards curing my eyes. The 14th of July. Up and to my office, where sat all the morning, at noon home to dinner, and thence all the afternoon hard at the office, we meeting about, who met us at the play, and anon comes Manuel and his wife, and Nip and Harris, who brings with him Mr. Bannister, the great master of music. And after much difficulty in getting of music, we to dancing, and then to a supper of some French dishes, which yet did not please me. And then to dance, and sing, and mighty merry we were till about 11 or 12 at night, with mighty great content in all my company. And I did, as I love to do, enjoy myself in my pleasure, as being the height of what we take pains for, and can hope for in this world. And therefore to be enjoyed while we are young and capable of these joys. My wife, extraordinary fine today in her flower tabby suit, bought a year or more ago before my mother's death put her into mourning, and so not worn till this day, and everybody in love with it, and indeed she is very fine and handsome in it. I, having paid the reckoning, which came to almost £4, we parted. My company and William Batelier, who was also with us, home in a coach round, whereof, by my Lord Sandwich's favour, I am one, and take it not only as a matter of honour, but that may come to be of profit to me. And so, with great content, went and called my wife, and so home and to the office, where busy, late, and so home to supper and to bed. The 11th of March. Up and by coach to my Lord Sandwich's, who not being up, I stayed talking with Mr. Moore till my Lord was ready, and come down and went directly out, without calling for me or seeing anybody. I know not whether he knew I was there, but I am apt to think not, because if he would have given me that slighting, yet he would not have done it to others that were there. So I went back again, doing nothing but discoursing with Mr. Moore, who I find by discourse to be grown rich, and indeed not to use me at all with the respect he used to do, but as his equal. He made me known to their chaplain, who is a worthy able man. Thence home, and by and by to the coffee-house, and thence to the change, and so home to dinner, and after a little chat with my wife to the office, where all the afternoon till very late at the office busy. And so home to supper and to bed, hoping in God that my diligence, as it is really very useful for the king, so it will end in profit to myself. In the meantime I have good content in mind to see myself improve every day in knowledge, and being known. The 12th of March. Lay long, pleasantly entertaining myself with my wife, and then up and to the office, where busy till noon, vexed to see how Sir John Minnis deserves rather to be pitied for his dotage and folly than employed at a great salary to ruin the king's business. At noon to the change, and thence home to dinner, and then down to Deptford, where busy a while, and then walking home it fell harder raining. So at halfway house put in, and there meeting Mr. Stacy with some company of pretty women, I took him aside to a room by ourselves, and there talked with him about the several sorts of tars, and so by and by parted, and I walked home, and there lay life abroad with Mistress Turner, and I to the office, where busy all the afternoon, and in the evening by coach to St. James's, and there met Sir William Coventry, and he and I walked in the park an hour, and then to his chamber, where he read to me the heads of the late great dispute between him and the rest of the commissioners of the Treasury, and our new Treasurer of the Navy, where they have overthrown him, the last Wednesday, in the great dispute touching his having the payment of the victualler, which is now settled by council that he is not to have it. And indeed they have been most just, as well as most severe and bold, in the doing this against a man of his quality. But I perceive he doth really make no difference between any man. He tells me this day it is supposed the peace is ratified at Breda, and all that matter over. We did talk of many retrenchments of charge of the Navy, which he will put in practice, and everywhere else, though he tells me he despairs of being able to do what ought to be done for the saving of the kingdom, which I tell him, as indeed all by the wall, where we met so many stops by the watches that it cost us much time, and some trouble, and more money to every watch to them to drink, this being increased by the trouble the prentices did lately give the city, so that the militia and watches are very strict at this time. And we had like to have met with a stop for all night at the constable's watch at Moorgate, by a pragmatical constable. But we came well home at about 2 in the morning, and so to bed. This noon, from Mistress Williams, my Lord Brunker sent to Somerset House to hear how the Duchess of Richmond doth, and word was brought him that she is pretty well, but mighty full of the smallpox, by which all do conclude she will be wholly spoilt, which is the greatest instance of the uncertainty of beauty that could be in this age. But then she hath had the benefit of it, to be first married, and to have kept it so long under the greatest temptation in the world from a king, and yet without the least imputation. This afternoon at the play, Sir Vittler's new contract, and so into the garden my Lady Penn, Mistress Turner and her daughter, my wife and I, and there supped in the dark and were merry, and so to bed. This day Boss finished his copy of my picture, which I confess I do not admire, though my wife prefers him to Brown, nor do I think it like. He doth it for Will Hewer, who hath my wife's also, which I like less. This afternoon my Lady Pickering came to see us. I busy, saw her not. But how natural it is for us to slight people out of power, and for people out of power to stoop to see those that while in power they contemned. The 15th of July. Up and all the morning busy at the office to my great content, tending to the settling of papers there, that I may have the more rest in winter for my eyes by how much I do the more in the settling of all things in the summer by daylight. At noon, home to dinner, where is brought home the espinette at the office, and so home to supper and to bed. The 13th of March. Lord's Day. I lay long in bed talking with my wife, and then up, in great doubt whether I should not go see Mr. Coventry or no, who hath not been well these 2 or 3 days, but it being foul weather I stayed within, and so to my office, and there all the morning reading some common law, to which I will allot a little time now and then, for I much want it. At noon, home to dinner, and then, after some discourse with my wife, to the office again. And by and by Sir William Penn came to me after sermon, and walked with me in the garden. And then one comes to tell me that Anthony and William Joyce were come to see me, so I into them and made mighty much of them, and very pleasant we were. And most of their business I find to be to advise about getting some woman to attend my brother Tom, whom they say is very ill and seems much to want one, to which I agreed, and desired them to get their wives to inquire out one. By and the world is almost in hopes of, upon the proceeding of these gentlemen for the regulating of the treasury, it being so late, and our poverty grown so great, that they want where to set their feet to begin to do anything. He tells me how weary he hath for this year and a half been of the war, and how in the Duke of York's bedchamber at Christchurch at Oxford, when the court was there, he did labour to persuade the Duke to fling off the care of the navy, and get it committed to other hands, which, if he had done, would have been much to his honour, being just come home with so much honour from sea as he did. I took notice of the sharp letter he wrote, which he sent us to read yesterday, to Sir Edward Spragg, where he is very plain about his leaving his charge of the ships at Gravesend, when the enemy came last up, and several other things, a copy whereof I have kept. But it is done like a most worthy man, and he says it is good, now and then, to tell these gentlemen their duties, for they need it. And it seems, as he tells me, all our knights are fallen. Ashville Hollis spoke to me as a secret and matter of confidence in me and friendship, to Sir William Penn, who is now out of town, that it were well he were made acquainted that he finds in the House of Commons, which met this day, several motions made for the calling strictly again upon the miscarriages, and particularly in the business of the prizes and the not prosecuting of the first victory, only to give an affront to Sir William Penn, whose going to sea this year doth give the matter of great dislike. So though I do not much trouble myself for him, yet I am sorry that he should have this fall so unhappily, without any fault but rather merit of his own that made him fitter for this command than anybody else, and the more for that this business of his may happily occasion their more eager pursuit against the whole body of the office. The 27th of March. Up and walked to the waterside, and thence to Whitehall to the Duke of York's chamber, where, he being ready, he went to a committee of Tangier, where I first understand that my Lord Sandwich is in his court the other day at Holwood. Cost me £5. So to St. James's, where did our ordinary business with the Duke of York, and so to Unthanks, to my wife, and with her and Deb to visit Mistress Pierce, whom I do not now so much affect since she paints. But stayed here a while, and understood from her how my Lady Duchess of Monmouth is still lame, and likely all way to be so, which is a sad chance for a young lady to get, only by trying of tricks in dancing. So home, and there Captain Dean came and spent the evening with me to draw some finishing lines on his fine draft of the Resolution, the best ship, by all report, in the world. And so to bed, wonderful hot all day and night, and this the first night that I remember in my life, that ever I could lie with only a sheet and one rug. So much I am now stronger than ever I remember myself to be, at least since before I had the stone. The 16th of July. Up and to the office, why they bid me good night, but immediately as they were gone out of doors comes Mistress Turner's boy with a note to me, to tell me that my brother Tom was so ill, as they feared he could not long live, and that it would be fit I should come and see him. So I sent for them back, and they came, and Will Joyce, desiring to speak with me alone, I took him up, and there he did plainly tell me, to my great astonishment, that my brother is deadly ill, and that their chief business of coming was to tell me so, and, which is worse, that his disease is the pox, which he hath heretofore got, and hath not been cured, but is come to this, and that this is certain, though a secret told his father Fenner by the doctor which he helped my brother to. This troubled me mightily, but, however, I thought fit to go see him, for speech of people's sake, and so walked along with them, and in our way called on my uncle Fenner, where I have not been this 12 months and more, and advised with him, and then to my brother, who lies in bed, talking idle. He could only say that he knew me, and then fell to us coming back from Spain, to step over thither to see in what condition the place is, which I am glad of, hoping that he will be able to do some good there for the good of the place, which is so much out of order. Thence to walk a little in Westminster Hall, where the Parliament I find sitting, but spoke with nobody to let me know what they are doing, nor did I inquire. Thence to the Swan, and drank, and did Bezar Frank, and so down by water, back again, and to the Exchange a turn or two, only to show myself, and then home to dinner, where my wife and I had a small squabble, but I first this day tried the effect of my silence and not provoking her when she is in an ill humour, and do find it very good, for it prevents its coming to that height on both sides, which used to exceed what was fit between us. So she became calm by and by, and fond, and so took coach and she to the mercer's to buy some lace, while I to Whitehall but did nothing, but then to Westminster Hall and took a turn, and so to Mistress Martin's, out one with another, he and Jennings and Hollis, and his words were, they are disputing which is the coward among them, and yet men that take the greatest liberty of censuring others. Here with him very late, till I could hardly get a coach or link willing to go through the ruins, but I do, but will not do it again, it being indeed very dangerous. So home, and to supper and bed, my head being full of an answer I have drawn this afternoon to the committee of the council, to whom carcasses business is referred to be examined again. The 10th of August.
Of doing it with almost no fatigue. Then he came once more into a region of ripple trees. This time the wind was blowing the streamers not down the mountainside, but up it, so that his course had to the eye the astonishing appearance of lying through a wide blue waterfall which flowed the wrong way, curving and foaming towards the heights. Whenever the wind failed for a second or two, the extreme ends of the streamers began to curl back under the influence of gravitation, so that it looked as if the heads of the waves were being flung back by a high wind. He continued going up through this for a long time, never feeling any real need for rest, but resting occasionally nonetheless. He was now so high that the crystal cliffs from which he had set out appeared on a level with him as he looked back across the valley. He now saw that the land leaped up beyond them into a whole waste of the same translucent formation, which ended in a kind of glassy tableland. Under the naked sun of our own planet, this would have been too bright to look at. Here it was a tremulous dazzle, changing every moment under the undulations which the Perelandrian sky receives from the ocean. To the left of this tableland were some peaks of greenish rock. He went on. Little by little the peaks and the tableland sank and grew smaller, and presently there arose beyond them an exquisite haze like vaporized amethyst and emerald and gold. And the edge of this haze rose as he rose, and became at last the horizon of the sea, high lifted above the hills. And the sea grew ever larger, and the mountains less, and the horizon of the sea rose and rose till all the lower mountains behind him seemed to be lying at the bottom of a great bowl of sea. But ahead, the interminable slope, now blue, now violet, now flickering with the smoke-like upward movement of the ripple trees, soared up and up to the sky. And now the wooded valley in which he had met the singing beast was invisible, and the mountain from which he had set out looked no more than a little swell on the slope of the great mountain. And there was not a bird in the air, nor any creature underneath the streamers. And still he went on, unwearied, but always bleeding a little from his heel. He was not lonely nor afraid. He had no desires, and did not even think about reaching the top, nor why he should reach it. To be always climbing this was not, in his present mood, a process, but a state. And in that state of life he was content. It did once cross his mind that he had died and felt no weariness because he had no body. The wound in his heel convinced him that this was not so. But if it had been so indeed, and these had been transmortal mountains, his journey could hardly have been more great and strange. That night he lay on the slopes between the stems of the ripple trees, with the sweet-scented, wind-proof, delicately whispering roof above his head, and when morning came he resumed his journey. At first he climbed through dense mists. When these parted, he found himself so high that the concave of the sea seemed to close him in on every side but one, and on that one he saw the rose-red peaks, no longer very distant, and a pass between the two nearest ones through which he caught a glimpse of something soft and flushed. And now he began to feel a strange mixture of sensations. A sense of perfect duty to enter that secret place which the peaks were guarding, combined with an equal sense of trespass. He dared not go up that pass. He dared not do otherwise. He looked to see an angel with a flaming sword. He knew that Maleldil bade him go on. "This is the holiest and the most unholy thing I have ever done," he thought. But he went on. And now he was right in the pass. The peaks on either hand were not of red rock. Cores of rock they must have had. But what he saw were great Matterhorns clothed in flowers, a flower shaped something like a lily, but tinted like a rose. And soon the ground on which he trod was carpeted with the same flowers, and he must crush them as he walked. And here at last his bleeding left no visible trace. From the neck between the two peaks he looked a little down, for the top of the mountain was a shallow cup. He saw a valley, a few acres in size, as secret as a valley in the top of a cloud. A valley pure rose-red, with 10 or 12 of the glowing peaks about it, and in the centre a pool, married in pure, unrippled clearness to the gold of the sky. The lilies came down to its very edge and lined all its bays and headlands. Yielding without resistance to the awe which was gaining upon him, he walked forward with slow paces and bowed head. There was something white near the water's edge. An altar? A patch of white lilies among the red? A tomb? But whose tomb? No, it was not a tomb, but a coffin, open and empty, and its lid lying beside it. Then, of course, he understood. This thing was own brother to the coffin-like chariot in which the strength of angels had brought him from Earth to Venus. It was prepared for his return. If he had said, "It is for my burial," his feelings would not have been very different. and while he thought of this, he became gradually aware that there was something odd about the flowers at two places in his immediate neighbourhood. Next, he perceived that the oddity was an oddity in the light. Thirdly, that it was in the air as well as on the ground. Then, as the blood pricked his veins and a familiar yet strange sense of diminished being possessed him, he knew that he was in the presence of two Eldila. He stood still. It was not for him to speak. Chapter 16. A clear voice, like a chime of remote bells, a voice with no blood in it, spoke out of the air and sent a tingling through his frame. "They have already set foot on the sand and are beginning to ascend," it said. "The small one from Tholkandra is already here," said a second voice. "Look on him, beloved, and love him," said the first. "He is indeed but breathing dust, and a careless touch would unmake him. And in his best thoughts there are such things mingled as, if we thought them, our light would perish. But he is in the body of Maleldil, and his sins are forgiven. His very name in his own tongue is Elwin, the friend of the Eldila." "How great is your knowledge," said the second voice. "I have been down into the air of Tholkandra," said the first, "which the small ones call Telus. A thickened air is full of the darkened, as deep heaven is of the light ones. I have heard the prisoners there talking in their divided tongues, and Elwin has taught me how it is with them." From these words, Ransom knew the speaker was the Oyarsa of Malakandra, the great Archon of Mars. He did not, of course, recognize the voice, for there is no difference between one Eldil's voice and another's. It is by art, not nature, that they affect human eardrums, and their words owe nothing to lungs or lips. "If it is good, Oyarsa," said Ransom, "tell me who is this other?" "It is Oyarsa," said Oyarsa, "and here that is not my name. In my own sphere I am Oyarsa, here I am only Malakandra." "I am Perelandra," said the other voice. "I do not understand," said Ransom. "The woman told me there were no Eldila in this world." "They have not seen my face till today," said the second voice, "except as they see it in the water and the roof heaven, the islands, the caves, and the trees. I was not set to rule them, but while they were young I ruled all else. I rounded this ball when it first rose from Arbol. I spun the air about it and wove the roof. I built the fixed island and this, the holy mountain, as Maleldil taught me. The beasts that sing and the beasts that fly and all that swims on my breast and all that creeps and tunnels within me down to the center has been mine. And today all this is taken from me, blessed be he." "The small one will not understand you," said the Lord of Malakandra. "He will think that this is a grievous thing in your eyes." "He does not say this, Malakandra." "No. That is another strange thing about the children of Adam." There was a moment's silence, and then Malakandra addressed Ransom. "You will think of this best if you think of it in the likeness of certain things from your own world." "I think I understand," said Ransom. "For one of Maleldil's sayers has told us, it is like when the children of a great house come to their full age. Then those who administered all their riches, and whom perhaps they have never seen, come and put all in their hands and give up their keys." "You understand well," said Perelandra, "or like when the singing beast leaves the dumb dam who suckled him." "The singing beast?" said Ransom. "I would gladly hear more of this." "The beasts of that kind have no milk, and always what they bring forth is suckled by the she-beast of another kind. She is great and beautiful and dumb. Until the young singing beast is weaned, it is among her whelps and is subject to her. But when it is grown, it becomes the most delicate and glorious of all beasts and goes from her, and she wonders at its song." "Why has Maleldil made such a thing?" said Ransom. "That is to ask why Maleldil has made me," said Perelandra. "But now it is enough to say that from the habits of these two beasts much wisdom will come into the minds of my king and my queen and their children. But the hour is upon us, and this is enough."
"What hour?" asked Ransom.
"Today is the morning day," said one or other or both the voices. But there was something much more than sound about Ransom, and his heart began beating fast. "The morning? Do you mean," he asked, "is all well? Has the queen found the king?" "The world is born today," said Malakandra. Today, for the first time, two creatures of the low worlds, two images of Maleldil that breathe and breed like the beasts, step up that step at which your parents fell and sit in the throne of what they were meant to be. It was never seen before. Because it did not happen in your world, a greater thing happened, but not this. Because the greater thing happened in Tholkandra, this and not the greater thing happens here. "Elwyn is falling to the ground," said the other voice. "Be comforted," said Malakandra. "It is no doing of yours. You are not great, though you could have prevented a thing so great that deep heaven sees it with amazement. Be comforted, small one, in your smallness. He lays no merit on you. Receive and be glad. Have no fear, lest your shoulders be bearing this world. Look, it is beneath your head and carries you." "Will they come here?" asked Ransom some time later. "They are already well up the mountain's side," said Perelandra, "and our hour is upon us. Let us prepare our shapes. We are hard for them to see while we remain in ourselves." "It is very well said," answered Malakandra. "But in what form shall we show ourselves to do them honour?" "Let us appear to the small one here," said the other, "for he is a man and can tell us what is pleasing to their senses." I can see something even now," said Ransom. "Would you have the king strain his eyes to see those who come to do him honour?" said the Archon of Perelandra. "But look on this, and tell us how it deals with you." The very faint light, the almost imperceptible alteration in the visual field, which betokens an Eldil, vanished suddenly. The rosy peaks and the calm pool vanished also. A tornado of sheer monstrosities seemed to be pouring over Ransom. Darting pillars filled with eyes, lightning pulsations of flame, talons and beaks and billowy masses of what suggested snow volleyed through cubes and heptagons into an infinite black void. "Stop it! Stop it!" he yelled, and the scene cleared. He gazed round, blinking on the field of lilies, and presently gave the Eldila to understand that this kind of appearance was not suited to human sensations. "Look then on this," said the voices again. And he looked with some reluctance, and far off between the peaks on the other side of the little valley there came rolling wheels. There was nothing but that, concentric wheels moving with a rather sickening slowness one inside the other. There was nothing terrible about them if you could get used to their appalling size, but there was also nothing significant. He bade them to try yet a third time, and suddenly two human figures stood before him on the opposite side of the lake. They were taller than the Sorns, the giants whom he had met in Mars. They were perhaps 30 feet high. They were burning white like white-hot iron. The outline of their bodies, when he looked at it steadily against the red landscape, seemed to be faintly, swiftly undulating, as though the permanence of their shape, like that of waterfalls or flames, coexisted with a rushing movement of the matter it contained. For a fraction of an inch inward from this outline, the landscape was just visible through them. Beyond that, they were opaque. Whenever he looked straight at them, they appeared to be rushing towards him with enormous speed. Whenever his eyes took in their surroundings, he realized that they were stationary. This may have been due in part to the fact that their long and sparkling hair stood out straight behind them, as if in a great wind. But if there were a wind, it was not made of air, for no petal of the flowers was shaken. They were not standing quite vertically in relation to the floor of the valley. But to Ransom it appeared, as it had appeared to me on Earth when I saw one, that the Eldils were vertical. It was the valley, it was the whole world of Perelandra, which was aslant. He remembered the words of Oyarsa long ago in Mars, "I am not here in the same way that you are here." It was borne in upon him that the creatures were really moving, though not moving in relation to him. This planet, which inevitably seemed to him while he was in it an unmoving world, the world, in fact, was to them a thing moving through the heavens. In relation to their own celestial frame of reference, they were rushing forward to keep abreast of the mountain valley. Had they stood still, they would have flashed past him too quickly for him to see, doubly dropped behind by the planet's spin on its own axis and by its onward march around the sun. Their bodies, he said, were white, but a flush of diverse colours began at about the shoulders and streamed up the necks and flickered over face and head and stood out around the head like plumage or a halo. He told me he could, in a sense, remember these colours, that is, he would know them if he saw them again, but that he cannot by any effort call up a visual image of them, nor give them any name. The very few people with whom he and I can discuss these matters all give the same explanation. We think that when creatures of the hypersomatic kind choose to appear to us, they are not in fact affecting our retina at all, but directly manipulating the relevant parts of our brain. If so, it is quite possible that they can produce there the sensations we should have if our eyes were capable of receiving those colours in the spectrum which are actually beyond their range. The plumage or halo of the one Eldil was extremely different from that of the other. The Oyarsa of Mars shone with cold and mourning colours, a little metallic, pure, hard and bracing. The Oyarsa of Venus glowed with a warm splendour, full of the suggestion of teeming vegetable life. The faces surprised him very much. Nothing less like the angel of popular art could well be imagined. The rich variety, the hint of undeveloped possibilities which make the interest of human faces, were entirely absent. One single changeless expression, so clear that it hurt and dazzled him, was stamped on each, and there was nothing else there at all. In that sense, their faces were as primitive, as unnatural, if you like, as those of archaic statues from Aegina. What this one thing was, he could not be certain. He concluded, in the end, that it was charity. But it was terrifyingly different from the expression of human charity, which we always see either blossoming out of or hastening to descend into natural affection. Here there was no affection at all, no least lingering memory of it, even at 10 million years' distance, no germ from which it could spring in any future, however remote. Pure, spiritual, intellectual love shot from their faces like barbed lightning. It was so unlike the love we experience that its expression could easily be mistaken for ferocity. Both the bodies were naked, and both were free from any sexual characteristics, either primary or secondary.